Okay, so I have to begin my talk actually with a bit of a confession, which is that I was asked to speak to you guys and to tell you what we know about the atmospheres of sub-Neptune-sized planets. And the reality is that despite several large observing campaigns with Hubble and Spitzer, at the present time we know almost nothing about the atmospheres of these planets. So what I'm going to tell you today is what little we do know, what our hopes are for knowing more in the future, and to kind of give you a sense of where we're at and where we're going with the field. So just to sort of orient ourselves, you guys saw plots like this quite often yesterday. So this is just the masses and radii for all of the planets where we have both measurements. And so this is actually a plot that Leslie showed in her talk yesterday. And so I just want to show you this to remind you of sort of the general trend that we see emerging from these large exoplanet surveys, which everyone talked about yesterday. So with a mass and a radius, you can calculate an average density for the planet, and you can compare that to the theoretical mass-radius relations for planets of varying compositions. And so you can ask to zeroth order what kind of planet it is that you found. So we have a lot of planets up here, which are analogous to Jupiter and Saturn. So these planets have average densities which are consistent with a primarily hydrogen and helium composition. But there's an interesting thing which is happening as you move down towards planets at smaller masses and radii, which is to say that these planets, which are similar in size to Neptune and Uranus, seem to have larger average densities, suggesting that they have a larger, solid, rocky or icy core surrounded by a thick mantle of hydrogen and helium. As you move even further down into the left, we start to see the emergence of some planets which are probably rocky, with at most a thin atmosphere on top. So viewing this sort of aggregate trend, one of the questions that we would like to address on the atmosphere side is how the atmospheres of these planets vary as a function of their mass. So we know that these planets up here must have hydrogen and helium atmospheres, but that's clearly not going to be true as you move down the mass spectrum. So at what point do we start to see the hydrogen disappear? At what point do we start to see perhaps outgassed atmospheres, similar to those of the rocky planets in our own solar system? And what on Earth is going on in this jumbled mess in between, where we have these super-Earths, which we have no solar system analog, where we don't understand how they form, and yet we see that they are extremely common in the universe? So this is really the region that I'm going to focus on most in my talk today, is this things that are smaller than Uranus and Neptune, but still substantially larger than the Earth, because that's kind of the frontier of where our atmosphere studies are today. Okay, so if I could tell you what the atmospheric composition of each of these planets was, we would learn a couple of things. One is that we would know more about how they formed. So for example, do they accrete their atmospheres directly from the protoplanetary disk? Are they outgassing their atmospheres from material that they accreted as solids? Did they form in the inner part of the disk? Did they form beyond the ice line? So the atmospheric composition offers us clues to all of these questions. One other very important thing that the atmosphere can tell us is it can tell us more about the interior composition of the planet. In particular, if all we have is a mass and radius, there is a degeneracy for planets at intermediate densities between rocky planets with hydrogen and helium atmospheres and planets which are primarily water-dominated compositions. So there's an ambiguity in the mass radius measurements which can be resolved by measurements of the planet's atmosphere. So just to sort of remind ourselves, I know this is the first talk of the morning, so I thought I'd kind of start out slow. Some of the basic things that we're looking for with atmospheres, so we think that the gas giant planets in our own solar system have what I would call primordial atmospheres, which is to say that these are hydrogen, helium-dominated gas, which is accreted directly from the protoplanetary disk with some perhaps moderate enrichment of heavier elements. So for example, Neptune has a carbon to hydrogen ratio, which is a bit larger than that of Jupiter. So not all gas giants are created alike, but certainly they're primarily hydrogen dominated. On the small end of the spectrum, we see that terrestrial planets have very thin atmospheres, which typically have a much higher mean molecular weight. We think that these atmospheres were originally accreted in the form of solids and then outgassed during the planet formation process. So this is sort of the solar system paradigm of atmospheres. What we don't know is how it applies or doesn't apply to extrasolar planetary systems. So in particular, we have these large population of planets which are intermediate in mass between the terrestrial planets and the gas giants, and we have no idea what those planets are made of. And I should mention also that the present-day atmospheres that we see may also have been modified in time by the loss of light elements due to irradiation from the star and also stripping from the solar wind. So there's sort of a secondary complication. One is, what is the atmosphere the planet started with? The other is, what is the atmosphere that we see it with today? And this is a particularly important question for extrasolar planets, because many of them orbit very close to their host stars. So some of them may have atmospheres which have been significantly modified in time. All right, so that's sort of the paradigm for what might be going on. We don't have any idea what these super-Earths are going to do. So they're large enough that it is very plausible that some of them might have hydrogen and helium atmospheres of some mass. They are also small enough that it's not necessarily true that they have to accrete gas from the nebula. So you could imagine that some of these might in fact be water worlds with a steam atmosphere, might be terrestrial planets with a thin outgassed atmosphere. So there's a large diversity of outcomes which are possible, and knowing which actually occurs in practice and even which is the most common will tell us something about how these planets form and where they form as well. So the other point that I mentioned is that measuring an atmospheric composition for the planet can break degeneracies in the interior composition constraints based on mass and radius alone. And so just to illustrate that for you, here's a mass radius plot which is zoomed in on the super-Earths. So in particular, I'd like to draw your attention to these three planets right here. So the two black circles and then the red circle. So these three planets are highlighted in this plot because they happen to be the one of sort of the handful of super-Earths which are around relatively bright nearby stars, for which we actually can get information about their atmospheres. That's particularly useful because it turns out that these planets are right in this awkward in-between regime. You can see that they fall pretty close to the mass radius line for a planet which has a significant fraction of water in its interior. So at first, you might look at that and go, oh, these are water worlds. You know, they orbit very close to their star now, but they probably formed beyond the ice line and then migrated in. So that's the story you could tell for these planets. But we have to be careful not to be tricked by this average density measurement, because we could imagine making an identical a planet with an identical mass and radius simply by having a somewhat larger rocky core and then surrounding that core with the hydrogen helium envelope. So the presence of light atmospheres can puff up the observed radii of planets, decrease their average densities, and confuse us into thinking that it's a different kind of planet than it actually is. And so in order to break that degeneracy between these different scenarios, and I should mention that this is a particularly interesting degeneracy because, as I said before, we think that this kind of planet, this water world, probably formed beyond the ice line. But this kind of planet, a rocky planet with a little hydrogen helium atmosphere, could have formed in place very close to the star. So knowing which of these types these planets are will tell us something about where super-Earths come from. Okay, so since I'm the first atmospheres talk, I get to tell you how we study the atmospheres of extrasolar planets. This will be very familiar to some of you, and others will never have seen this before, so let me go through it. So you heard yesterday that when the planet passes in front of the star, it blocks part of the star's light. And by measuring the depth of that eclipse, we can learn the radius of the planet relative to the radius of the star. What they didn't tell you yesterday is for a planet with an atmosphere, that atmosphere will be opaque at some wavelengths and transparent at others. So when the planet passes in front of the star, the amount of light the planet blocks will be wavelength dependent. And that wavelength dependent transit depth will tell you something about the composition of the planet's atmosphere. So this is a way to learn about exoplanetary atmospheres. There's also a secondary measurement which we can make. So if you wait approximately half an orbit, the planet will actually, in most cases, go behind the star, disappear, and reappear. And so if you observe this secondary eclipse at infrared wavelengths, you can actually detect the thermal emission of the planet at different wavelengths, which tells you both about its composition, but also about the pressure-temperature profile of the atmosphere. So this is a complementary way to study atmospheric compositions. So the data that I'm going to show you today is mostly from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is probably the single best instrument we have today for studying the atmospheres of these planets, particularly for the transit technique. I'm also at the very end going to show you a little bit of data from the Spitzer Space Telescope. This telescope observes at slightly longer wavelengths, and so it's actually perfect for studying the secondary eclipses of these planets. And so I'm going to show you kind of a little bit of data from each, and we can maybe even think about how the combination of the two might be useful. Okay, so just to give you a little bit more information about the transit technique. So this is an example of some observations taken by Hubble. So here's the transit light curve when the planet passes in front of the star. This is broken down into different wavelengths spanning the optical regime. So the color indicates the wavelength. So here in purple are the shortest wavelengths, which are about 300 nanometers, going all the way out to about 900 nanometers on the top. So we want to measure the depth of this eclipse as a function of wavelength in each of these different bands. The reason I'm showing you this plot is to note that the shape of the transit also varies as a function of wavelength. So clearly, it's not just the planet that's changing as a function of wavelength. There's something else going on here. And that something else is the star itself. So if you look at the sun or any other star, you would see that it's darker at the edges and brighter at the center. So this effect is called limb darkening. And what it means in practice for transits is it means that when the planet occults the limb of the star, it's occulting a dimmer part of the star. And when it occults the center, it's occulting a brighter part. So that gives you this curvature in the transit light curve. And the magnitude of this effect is wavelength dependent. So although we have relatively good stellar atmosphere models, this still, for some planets, is becoming a limitation for this technique. So our ability to characterize the planet is limited by our knowledge of the star. And so one thing that the community is working on right now is actually this technique has revealed some sort of inadequacies in our current stellar models. And so there are people working to come up with better stellar models that might help improve these measurements and extract a more reliable planet radius measurement. Okay, so if, sort of setting aside our difficulties with the star, if we believe we can measure the depth of the transit as a function of wavelength, it tells us something to zeroth order about the mean molecular weight of the planet's atmosphere. And so I can show that with a little cartoon. So if you imagine that here's the solid planet with a blue atmosphere on top, that blue atmosphere is the sort of effective region in which the absorption is taking place. So the magnitude of this effect, this wavelength-dependent transit depth, is going to scale with the thickness of this blue annulus. So if you have an atmosphere which is very puffy and extended, has a large scale height, then you're going to have a thick annulus and you're going to see relatively strong absorption. If you have an atmosphere which has a small scale height, it's relatively compact, then the width of this annulus is smaller and you see very small absorption features. So the puffiness or compactness of the atmosphere can be parameterized by the scale height parameter, which is the temperature of the atmosphere divided by its surface gravity and its mean molecular weight. In most cases, we have a pretty good guess for what the temperature of the atmosphere is. We can calculate a surface gravity based on the measured mass and radius. So the biggest unknown in this scale height equation is the mean molecular weight of the atmosphere. So if we can measure that, then we can, if we can measure H, then we can back out mu, the mean molecular weight. And so just to illustrate this graphically, here is a set of models from a paper by Millerici and Fortney, which look at a hypothetical planet, actually in this case I think it was GJ1214, considering different types of atmospheres. And so these models predict the wavelength dependent transit depth that you would measure across the infrared. So this is 1 to 10 microns. So they considered relatively hydrogen rich compositions for the planet. So in red is a composition which is the same as that of the sun. Then they sort of take out a little bit of the hydrogen and helium, so modestly enhance the amount of heavier elements, and you can see that it has very little, relatively little effect on the shape of the features that you see. You still get these large wavelength dependent variations from water, carbon dioxide, and maybe a little bit of ammonia. The interesting thing is when you consider atmospheres which have no hydrogen and helium, so a pure water atmosphere, an atmosphere which is half water and half CO2, or an all CO2 atmosphere, you can see that those are also very self-similar and that they're all nearly constant as a function of wavelength. So this is due entirely to this mu term in the denominator. So the high mean molecular weight atmospheres are going to give you something which is a nearly flat transit depth as a function of wavelength. So even aside from measuring individual molecular absorption features, to zeroth order, I can tell you how much hydrogen is in a planet's atmosphere just by the strength of the absorption features that we observe. And so this is the thing we really want to know. For instance, for these intermediate density super-Earths, if we want to know if it's a water world or a ball of rock with a hydrogen atmosphere, this measurement would tell us which it is. Okay, so I thought I would start with with the easy case first. So this is actually not a super-Earth. This is a Neptune-sized planet. So it has a mass and a radius similar to Neptune in our own solar system, orbits relatively close to its star. So I would call it a warm Neptune. It's maybe 800 Kelvin. And so I like this one because we would expect to see this nice, very strong wavelength-dependent transit signal. So this is now looking in the near-infrared, 1.2 to 1.6 microns, with the Hubble Space Telescope, and measuring the wavelength dependence of the transit depth when the planet passes in front of its star. And so there are two models here, which represent the two sort of two scenarios you might consider. One is that this planet is a Neptune analog, in which case we should see a big, strong water absorption feature here. The other is that it's somehow not at all like Neptune, that it has very little hydrogen and helium in its atmosphere, in which case you would see something which looks much flatter as a function of wavelength. So here in black are our actual measurements. So you can see that, interestingly, you know, even though I said this planet looked exactly like Neptune, we see that the transit depth that we measure with Hubble is basically constant as a function of wavelength, so that it's much more consistent with this very hydrogen-poor atmosphere. So that's kind of surprising. And if that is the explanation, then it means that this planet probably formed very differently than Neptune in our own solar system. However, as you can see from my little cartoon in the corner here, there is a third possibility, which I didn't mention earlier, which is that this planet might have a very high altitude cloud layer. So if you imagine placing clouds very high up in the atmosphere, you might imagine that they could block this little blue annulus that would be doing the absorbing and hide the absorption features that you would otherwise expect to see. So clouds can trick us into thinking that we have a compact, high mean molecular weight atmosphere, when in reality we just have something which is blocking the absorption signal that we expected to see. So based on these data alone, this green model would be the cloudy model. You can see it also is a good match for the data. So for this planet, based on these data alone, we can't tell the difference between these two scenarios. Now, if you look closely, you see that there are different features here. So if we could increase the precision of our measurements, eventually we can tell the difference. But for typical measurement errors, often it is difficult to distinguish between these two possibilities. So if you think this planet might be cloudy, and again, I'm talking about this even though it's a Neptune, because it turns out to be a good analog for a lot of the super-Earths that I'm going to show you next. So if you think it might be clouds that are causing this featureless spectrum, you might ask what kinds of clouds we would expect to see on this planet. And there are sort of two general classes of possibilities. One is that you have condensate clouds, which for this particular planet would probably be something like zinc sulfide or potassium chloride. And that's just based on drawing the pressure temperature profile of the planet, condensation curves of different molecules, and thinking about which molecules are relatively common in the atmosphere and condense at the right point in the atmosphere to give you this high altitude cloud deck. So for depending on the specific planet you're talking about, you might get very different condensate cloud compositions, but this is, for this particular one, what works out to be at least plausible. The other possibility is that you might have photochemical soots. So in particular, this planet is cool enough to have methane in the atmosphere. If we look at Titan as an example, we see that Titan actually has a relatively thick haze in its atmosphere, which is caused by the conversion of methane into long hydrocarbon chains. So if this planet also has methane, it might also have a similar hydrocarbon haze in its atmosphere. So it orbits a relatively low mass star, but this star has plenty of ultraviolet light, so certainly there could be photochemistry in the atmosphere. So those are at least two plausible possibilities. We don't really understand, well, we don't really have a way to test right now which is which. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on. But I at least want to show you that there is hope. So this is another observation of another Neptune-sized planet where we do detect atmospheric absorption. So this is an observation from Jonathan Frain that came out earlier this year. And so the same wavelength range, 1.2 to 1.6 microns, same instrument, Hubble, wavelength-dependent transit depth. And you can see that there's this nice wavelength-dependent variation corresponding to absorption from water in this Neptune's atmosphere. Now again here, this signal is a little bit attenuated from what you might expect for a hydrogen-rich kind of sun-like atmospheric composition. So you can fit it again either with an atmosphere which is modestly depleted in hydrogen, not very much, or you can also fit it with a solar metallicity kind of hydrogen-rich model, which has a little bit of a cloud deck, but further down because you only need to attenuate it a little bit. Yes. Yes, those are 1 sigma error bars.
I don't like you to have a pencil, but I can fit a straight line, flat line.
Yeah, it's inconsistent with the flat line. You could calculate, for instance, the chi-squared or the Bayesian information criterion. Sure. But when you, if you ask which model is statistically a better fit, you can rule out a flat line at reasonably high significance. Okay. So there's at least hope. So this is the smallest planet for which we detect atmospheric absorption right now. So this is sort of showing you the limits of where we are. We're at Neptune for detecting this signal. So we'd like to get down into the super-Earth regime. But you know, again, this is kind of a good illustration of the problems that we're running into in trying to push this down to even smaller planets. So you're going to see this sort of continued theme of, are there clouds in the atmosphere? Could the clouds hide the signature of what we would expect to see? So in a way, these Neptunes have been a good learning process for us because they've revealed the sort of limitations of this technique and some of the things that we like to ignore, like clouds, which turn out to potentially be very important in these atmospheres. Okay, so I said that was the smallest planet for which we detected atmospheric absorption. I've kind of given away the next couple of slides, which is to say we have tried this observation for super-Earths, and so I'm going to show you the results now of the same kind of observation for smaller planets. And just to remind you again, what we're trying to do here is for these intermediate density super-Earths, which are sort of 5 to 10 times the mass of the Earth, we want to know if these are water worlds or if these are balls of rock with hydrogen and helium on top. So do they form beyond the ice line or do they form in place close to the star? So we want to answer that by figuring out if they have a lot of hydrogen in their atmosphere, which would be consistent with this ball of rock in situ formation, or if they have a relatively heavy water-dominated atmosphere, which would be consistent with formation beyond the ice line. So we're going to apply the same technique to these planets and see what we find. So probably the best constrained observation to date, and this is actually even more constraining than the observations of Neptunes that I showed you before, is, again, 1.2 to 1.6 microns, Hubble observations. This is the super-Earth GJ1214, which is up here. And this is what they see. So this is a study by Laura Kreidberg et al., and there's actually an earlier study by Zach Berta with a somewhat lower precision. But so the Kreidberg et al. Is now the best precision that we have. So one thing you might notice if you look at the models that I'm plotting for comparison here, there's no hydrogen-rich model on this plot. So these data are so good, the hydrogen-rich model would be kind of up to the ceiling there and down off the bottom of the plot there. So it's very, very strongly inconsistent with anything with very much hydrogen at all in it. It also can rule out pure methane atmospheres, pure water atmospheres, and even at a somewhat lower level, a pure CO2 atmosphere. So the conclusion in this case, given that we know that this planet is a relatively low-density planet, is that it must have a cloud deck in the atmosphere because we ruled out everything else that it could have except clouds. So the interesting thing about that is that it turns out that if you look at cloud models, that you get the same kinds of clouds that you did for GJ-436 before. So the cloud candidates, again, for this one are zinc sulfide, potassium chloride, so this is work from Carolyn Morley, and also photochemical soots derived from methane. So this is an interesting example where, as you beat down the noise in the data, you actually do eventually break this degeneracy between cloudy and metal-rich. But unfortunately, breaking the degeneracy only tells us that it's definitely cloudy. And given that it's definitely cloudy, it still could be any of these other things, and the clouds are just hiding what you would like to see. So this has been the really frustrating part of these observations, is that the more closely we look at these planets, the more we find that these cloud layers are interfering with the signal that we would like to see and preventing us from answering this question that we originally posed, which is, are these hydrogen-rich or hydrogen-poor atmospheres? So did these planets form in place, or did they migrate in from beyond the ice line? So here's another super-Earth, which we looked at more recently. This is a somewhat noisier data set in that you can see here's the hydrogen-rich model, and so it's able to rule out that model, but it's still not nearly as sensitive as the previous observations that I showed you. I should note that these actually, the error bars here are 50% smaller than the ones on the previous plot. But the difference is that this super Earth orbits a more sun-like star, so the planet-star radius ratio is much smaller, and the signal that you're trying to measure scales accordingly. So this is a good illustration of the advantage of studying small planets transiting small stars. So you make the problem easier for yourself with small stars because you make these signals larger that you're trying to detect. Okay, so in my last little bit of time, I want to provide you guys with a glimpse ahead and to figure out first how we can understand what these clouds are and where they're coming from, maybe even predict them in advance, and lastly, how we might kind of get around this problem of clouds. So there's a couple things we can do to understand the clouds. So one is if we observe the wavelength-dependent transit in the optical, we can measure the wavelength-dependent scattering of the cloud particles. That tells you something about their location in the atmosphere and also their size distribution. So that would be useful for examining different cloud candidate particles. The other thing we would really like to do is measure the wavelength-dependent albedos of these planets. And so that might tell us something about the cloud compositions. Different types of clouds will have different reflectivities. So this is a measurement that you could do by looking when the planet passes behind the star in visible light. So just to give you some more concrete examples, so if you could look in the optical during the transit, you might see something like this. So this is now simulated data, which will be taken, is being taken, and will be taken later this year. So this is an approved program on Hubble led by Bjorn Beneke and Ian Crossfield. And so this is the data that we had before in blue, and the data that the program will get in red, and in particular, sorry, in black. You'll notice that in the optical, if this planet has a hydrogen-rich atmosphere with a cloud deck, you can get this very steep slope across the optical, which is due to scattering from the cloud particles. And this signal is distinct from any scenario in which you have a hydrogen-poor, high mean molecular weight atmosphere. Those atmospheres will always be flat across the optical. So if you see this signal, then you know that you have a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, even though the clouds are hiding the signature of the absorption from the atmosphere. So this is one way to break the degeneracy, is go to optical wavelengths with the transit. Another way to understand the clouds better is to observe when the planet goes behind the star in visible light. So unfortunately, I think this is beyond what we can do with Hubble, at least for these super-Earths. But just as a proof of concept, I'd like to show you the one observation we do have, which is for a hot Jupiter. So this is for HD189733. So they observed the secondary eclipse in the optical wavelengths with STIS, and they found that the planet was more reflective at short wavelengths in the blue than it was in the red. And so this is kind of a fun thing. You know, I think we always draw hot Jupiters as these glowing red balls. But in fact, if you could view hot Jupiters with your own eyes, you would see that they were kind of dim and blue colored. But this is especially interesting because this planet also has clouds as inferred from the transmission spectrum. So this is an example of an albedo measurement for a planet which has a cloud deck, where the reflectivity in the blue is telling us something about the cloud composition. And this, for this particular planet, it's been suggested that it might have silicate condensate clouds. And so that, I think, is consistent with this wavelength-dependent reflection in the blue. OK, so the last point that I want to make is that if you look at cloudy planets, and by cloudy planets, I mean planets which have featureless transmission spectra, like the many that I showed you before, if you look at them during secondary eclipse at infrared wavelengths and you measure their wavelength-dependent emission at sort of a few microns out to maybe 10 or 20 microns, that for planets like GJ-436, which is the very first planet I showed you, totally flat transmission spectrum, this same planet, when viewed in its emitted light, has very definite spectral features. So in black are the individual secondary eclipse measurements made by Spitzer. And in red and in blue are different models having different ratios of methane to CO. But in particular, I'd like you to note this dashed line here, which is what a black body would look like. So if the planet was emitting as a black body, it would go like that. And you can see that these points deviate very strongly from a black body. So even planets which are cloudy when viewed in transit can have detectable atmospheric absorption features when viewed during secondary eclipse in the infrared. And so this particular planet is interesting because these observations seem to require that it has a relatively hydrogen-poor, metal-rich atmosphere, which would have much less hydrogen than Neptune in our own solar system. And so this is work by Julie Moses et al. Again, HD189733, so that was the other planet I mentioned, which is more reflective in the blue than in the red. It also has detectable features in its dayside emission spectrum. So it may be that this secondary eclipse technique is ultimately more robust to these kind of high altitude tenuous cloud layers that we see in transit. So this may be another workaround. Okay, so just to wrap up, so looking ahead. So I think you've heard many times yesterday that there's going to be these new missions. So K2 is going on now, TESS is coming up, which will find many new transiting planets. That's important because our limiter right now for super Earths is that there are only a handful which orbit right nearby stars. So we're in desperate need of more of these systems, and I think that's going to be delivered in the very near future. The other thing we need is a bigger telescope to study their atmospheres. The James Webb Space Telescope will do that for us. That being said, it's still going to be tough to get down to truly terrestrial planets with James Webb. And in particular, we can't realize the benefit of its larger mirror unless they are able to implement observing modes which are suitable for exoplanet observations. So in particular, if we are looking at a very bright star, we have to take very short integration times. It takes much longer to read out the array. So we're throwing away most of the light from the star that we need to make these measurements. And so I think there are opportunities still there to improve the capacity of this telescope for exoplanet observations. Okay, so here's where we're at right now for atmospheres. We're at Neptunes. We're trying to get to super Earths, detect some features for them, understand how they form, and eventually we'd like to get down to these terrestrial planets. So the questions that we're trying to tackle with these observations are whether or not these planets have primordial atmospheres that are accreted directly from the protoplanetary disk, whether or not they're outgassed, whether or not they've been depleted in light elements. For the super-Earths, we would like to break degeneracies in their interior compositions to know if there are such a thing as a water world out there, or if these are all balls of rock with hydrogen and helium on top. And eventually, if we had a terrestrial planet and a better telescope, we might perhaps want to know if the planet had an atmosphere which would maintain a climate which might be suitable for life as we know it. Okay, and with that, I'll take questions.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that to estimate the scale height, the mean molecular weight is the hard part, but the temperature was the easy part. Mm-hmm. How well do we know the temperatures? Do you have to assume a certain albedo? Do you have to assume there's no greenhouse effect? How well do we know the temperatures?
Yes, we assume all of those things to start with. So sometimes we can measure the temperature directly using the secondary eclipse. But more often, we don't have that measurement, and we just make an estimate based on the amount of light the planet receives from its star, some reasonable albedo. But I think the main point to make is, even if we've gotten that temperature wrong by several hundred Kelvin in either direction, it has a relatively small effect on the scale height compared to changing the mean molecular weight, which is an order of magnitude effect. So it is an uncertainty. It's one which is not the limiting factor in that measurement.
Follow up on the Eric question. I mean, the error bars that you calculate from this wonderful observation, the observation were taken at different transits, right? Because you need a lot of integration. Can we see the variation from one transit to another?
Yeah, so in particular...
Consistent with the error bars that you plot?
So as far as I know, all the published measurements with Hubble of all planets, hot Jupiters down to super-Earths, are self-consistent from epoch to epoch. So each individual transit is within the errors of the other individual transits. I might imagine a case where you have clouds which are only intermittently present, so you might sometimes see features and sometimes not. Certainly we look for that, but we haven't found it so far.
The difference between the Hubble observations and, for example, the previous BITS observations is that the Hubble basically gives us all these data points at the same time. So when Heather showed the spectrum of HD97658b, this was taken basically two transits, but basically each transit provided the entire spectrum. So if you do comparisons between different wavelengths, at least you don't have the difficulty of comparing different, at the same time comparing different epochs. So that's the difference between getting the spectra at the same time and doing photometric measurements.
Yeah, so one limiter.
Right. I think what Laura Kreitberg, or what we've shown in the 2014 paper about GJ12 and MB, what is really nice to show is that in these 12 transits that we analyzed, basically they all lead to consistent results. If you plot these 12, they were basically distributed in a Gaussian profile here.
So stars also vary in time, and that's a big limiter for some of these systems.
Yeah, I have a question concerning these cloudy layers. If you make simulations of what we would see for the planets of the solar system, how would they look like in terms? Would they also have rather flat spectrum, like for Venus, Earth, or Jupiter, or would you see very pronounced absorption variations?
Yeah, so it entirely depends on where the clouds are. If they're low enough in the atmosphere, there's still enough gas on top of them that you can see absorption. If they're very high up, that's what blocks the absorption. So maybe Bjorn can answer that if you've run models or if you've seen models of Jupiter or Saturn. Or maybe Adam can. Yes. Yes, there are also some published observations, maybe. All right. And it sounds like Jonathan has a good answer.
So Cassini in the Saturn system can look back at the sun and do solar occultations. And once you take refraction out, which is an important factor given the geometry of the solar system, you can use Cassini data to derive a transmission spectrum of Titan, and that's been published by Ty Robinson a few months ago. And what you see is that for Titan, although there's a really thick haze, and you can see the haze at essentially every wavelength, the methane bands in the atmosphere are strong enough that you can see the methane bands, but there's a very steep haze that's apparent due to the methane haze. And Phil Muirhead has a group working at BU to do the same thing for data for Saturn. And for Saturn, you clearly see the methane bands as well, although you can see the clouds. There is a chopping off of the absorption bands at the bottom. So it is strongly dependent on where the clouds are in the atmosphere, how high they are.
Just to follow up, there's also data of reflection off Ganymede through Jupiter's atmosphere,
right,
which is an amazing analog to exactly these sorts of systems, and you do see wavelength variations. It was just in the last month.
Yeah, it came out recently.
I was hoping somebody who was on the paper is in the audience. No.
I think I read Pi is on that paper.
It could be.
Yeah, so
it's well worth looking at. I looked at the paper, not the author list.
Yeah, so it's maybe worth noting that this is a result of the conversation between the solar system community and the exoplanet community, is that now people are making these measurements, so we can directly, if we pretend that our solar system planets were exoplanets, we can know what kind of signal we would measure and match that to the sort of ground truth from other types of observations.
One of the things to note is for Jupiter and Saturn, they're at large distances at low temperatures, and their transit spectra are going to be significantly different, I believe, than those that are in proximity to the central star, where the temperatures are larger and there's all sorts of potential for gook in the atmosphere.
So I have a comment and a question, and I'm going to follow up on these last series of talks, last series of brief talks added to your talk. Please, for those of us outside, completely outside of your community, I would have really liked to have seen what might be called, and I hesitate to use this word, ground truth, to sort of look at our own solar system and say what you could say and deconvolve the spectrum. I appreciate what Eric and Svi were saying about uncertainties, and I live in another field that has gross uncertainties, and they're about as big as a signal. But helping us to appreciate this. All right, now onto my question, because I'm really interested in that first one, primordial or outgassed, because I try to understand planets and how they come about. But I was constantly tweaked by your presentation saying it formed in situ or it formed not in situ. You seem to have approached with an a priori that I need to appreciate. Why do you think a certain gaseous envelope composition tells you about the formational process?
So, for one thing, if you have a water-rich atmosphere, it might be indicative of a water-rich interior. So the bulk water content of the planet does probably tell you something about where it formed. So I guess in that sense, I'm viewing the atmosphere as an extension of the interior. I think the main point I was making for super-Earths is that there's this degeneracy between a planet which has a bulk water envelope and one which is a ball of rock with hydrogen and helium on top. If all you have is a mass and a radius, you can't tell the difference between those two. So if you can show what kind of atmosphere it has, you can distinguish between these two scenarios. And that actually is indicative of where it formed.
Well, I live in this solar system, and I keep listening to the astronomy community, and they keep telling me that planets, a lot of the bodies in the solar system didn't form exactly where they formed. So why are you asserting that in another solar system, we know where they formed given their composition of the envelope?
So we're trying to narrow down the region in which they might have formed by understanding their bulk composition. So we're still not saying they formed exactly in place, but you can at least say broadly, are they forming, you know, way far out beyond the ice line, or are they forming in the inner warmer parts? So very rough distinction.
So from a non-astronomer perspective, this is the first talk, at least that I understood, the secondary ellipses. Mm-hmm. So that's just a weaker signal that happens out of phase with the primary ellipse, is that correct?
So it's when the planet passes behind the star. So normally when the planet's next to the star, you're actually seeing the combined light from the planet and star together. And mostly that doesn't matter to you because the planet is very, very faint compared to the star. And you can't take an image which allows you to resolve the two of them separate from each other. But when the planet blinks in and out by going behind the star, that allows you to see what the combined light is with the planet subtracted out and with the planet in. So you're differencing two things to figure out the contribution from the planet.
So how then do you get the... So you said you can also tell the difference between albedo and emission mm-hmm. by looking at that. And so that's by looking at the differences between the primary and secondary? Can you say more about
that? Yeah, so the difference between albedo and emitted light, what you would ideally want is observations both in the infrared and the visible, because you need the infrared to tell you the temperature of the planet so that you can figure out if your visible light measurement is actually just reflected light or if it also has some thermal emission from the planet. So the implicit assumption for these planets is that they're all so cold that any light that you detect in the optical, at least the by far the dominant contribution to the light you see in the optical is reflected light. But you can test that with observations in the infrared.
So Heather, you mentioned that I think it was Evans et al. Was pointing out that the blueness of the reflected light from one of these planets suggested the presence of clouds. But of course, Rayleigh scattering will also make a planet blue. So I assume this is somehow in excess of what you would predict from the Rayleigh scattering?
Yes. So this planet has an albedo of 0.3 across the optical. And I believe if you do the cloud-free models for these planets, which Adam and many other people have done, that you get albedos which are much, much lower than that, much below 0.1. So to get an albedo of 0.3, as I understand it, requires a reflective cloud layer.
If you just use Rayleigh scattering off the gas, it's not strong enough.
Yeah, it's quite a function of pressure.
In the models, it's not strong enough. Like by orders of magnitude.
Any last question while Eric sits up?
While you guys have a very hard time to see whether it's a water or H and so on, how this author particularly single out the zinc sulfide and potassium chloride as a potential volatile phase?
Yeah, so that argument is based on if you think about, so you can draw pressure, you can draw condensation curves as a function of pressure and temperature for different molecules in this kind of atmosphere. And so if you ask where the pressure temperature profile of the planet intersects those condensation curves, you can predict where the cloud layers would be for condensate clouds. So that's an argument based on those are the things that would condense at the top of the atmosphere and are also common enough to make an optically thick cloud layer, presumably.
And those are like the best molecules, the best suspects?
The best ones I've seen so far.
Until the new
Heather? And then the next talk this morning, What Are Little Worlds Made Of? Eric Guidos, take it away.